Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. You can also find us on Twitter at The Takeaway and on Facebook at facebook.com/The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And like so many human ice cubes, an estimated 140 million cold Americans have been plunged into the polar refreshment gripping much of the nation today, a cold drink being stirred by fierce winds and chilled by record low temperatures from Minnesota to Georgia. Maybe all of the warm bodies are more like little marshmallows bobbing on the surface of a polar vortex, it's called. Here's a couple of marshmallows.
I'm Luke, and as a 20-year-old Minnesotan, this weather has given me extra resolve to move to California for grad school. I feel like 20 winters has been enough for me.
This is Carissa Terranova in Dallas, Texas, and it's cold here. It's been in the 20s all day, and I've had to put sweaters on my chihuahuas to walk them outdoors. Where the sun penetrates through to the ground, it's hot, as though there's something wrong with the atmosphere.
Something wrong with the atmosphere? That's the experience of the polar vortex from two locations in the United States. For more on the science behind the polar vortex, we turn to Jennifer Francis, research professor at Rutgers University's Institute for Marine and Coastal Sciences. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you, John.
Are you warm enough wherever you are?
Well, I'm inside, so I'm fine, but it's pretty nippy out there. I agree with everybody else who's called in.
Well, respond to Carissa. Is there something wrong with the atmosphere?
There certainly is something wrong with the atmosphere. There's 40% more carbon dioxide in it now than there was only half a century ago, and that's having all kinds of interesting effects.
And the polar vortex, I've heard it described as a low-pressure system that's usually centered on the North Pole that, because of the jet stream, has sort of slipped south. Is that right?
Yes, that's basically right. The polar vortex is a feature of the Earth's atmospheric system, and it is this relative low and cold center over the Arctic, usually, that's surrounded by very fast-moving winds that we call the jet stream. And it can be kind of circular, but oftentimes it takes a more interesting shape as the winds travel around the northern hemisphere. And for the last 6 weeks or so, it's been in a very interesting shape.
Now, I've been reading a bunch about this, and I'm not a climate scientist, and it's hard for me to evaluate this, but there seems to be a consensus that while behavior of the atmosphere may be in general related to the carbon issues that you spoke about and global warming, that this particular event can't really be related to the global warming as we understand it in terms of the, you know, full climate of the Earth. Yes or no?
You are correct that this particular event we cannot directly link to global warming. But that said, this kind of event we think is going to become more likely as we go forward into the future. We've seen an uptick in the occurrence of these kinds of events. And when I say this event, I mean the jet stream is in a very, what we call an amplified pattern, meaning it's taking big swings north and big swings south. And when it does that, it creates extreme weather conditions in various places. So while we're dealing with extreme cold right now, Alaska has been feeling extreme warm, as has Scandinavia. And we know also that California has been had the driest year on record. UK has been battered by storm after storm. And all of these things are linked. And it's through the jet stream in this very unusual sort of a pattern.
Well, it may cause our friend Luke there in Minnesota to rethink his consideration of California as a place to go to grad school. Jennifer Francis, thanks so much.
Anytime.
Jennifer Francis is a research professor at Rutgers University Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences. So what are the tangible consequences on the ground as the jet stream slips south and the polar vortex slips south with it? Richard Thomas is the owner of the R. Thomas Deluxe Grill in Atlanta, Georgia. Welcome to the program, Richard.
Thank you. It's cold here.
Yeah, and I gather the birds are inside.
Yes, it was a bear for us to transport the birds, so we moved the birds to my office, 18 of them. And then we moved them to yesterday to the veterinarian because they were open on Monday, and they received all my birds. Thank God for them.
And this is the feature of your deluxe grill in Atlanta, Georgia. You've got 18 tropical birds perched outside the entrance. Normally, that's just a lovely kind of thing there in Atlanta. So you actually had to board the birds to deal with this polar vortex business.
Oh, I had to, yes. We've been there 29 years, and this has only happened to me once before. I worry about the birds when the temperature gets into the 20s. See, each bird has a ceramic heater above them, and some of the birds have a heated perch. But this situation with the wind was a different animal, and that's why I made the decision to move my babies. My oldest is 69, and she was the first one that I moved.
What are their names?
Her name is Sparkle, and she is 69. Then I have two other Amazons, Ollie and Charlie, and they're 40, and it just goes on.
Right, right. No, I got a good picture of that. Anything your restaurant customers have been saying about the cold?
We just hardly had any business at all yesterday. My restaurant seats 100 people, but it's outside on a patio that is covered, and we do have heaters, but we are struggling to keep a temperature where the customer would be comfortable. So it's one of these days we'll get through it. I think we'll be in trouble until about Thursday morning, and that's when I plan on moving my birds back.
All right. Well, good luck on that. Is there soup on the menu there at the Deluxe Grill?
Red potato corn chowder, and it is wonderful.
And hot, piping hot.
Yes.
Richard Thomas is the owner of the R. Thomas Deluxe Grill in Atlanta, Georgia, famous for all those tropical birds perched outside the entrance. They've been boarded with the veterinarian until at least Thursday. Richard, thanks so much.
Thank you, sir. Bye.
And it's not just birds that have to be taken inside.
This is Sue McCunn in Walterboro, South Carolina. I've taken in the plants, and I'm just going to pray for the best with the rest.
Polar vortex, what's your experience? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. So in other news, what is the message from the federal courts yesterday? A federal judge told violence-weary Chicagoans that its locally crafted regulations on legal gun sales were unconstitutional. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court in a Utah case threw into doubt hundreds of gay couples who got married in the past few weeks after a federal district judge declared Utah's ban on same-sex marriage unconstitutional. In both cases, it looks like a collision between state preferences, local morality, and federal authority. In both cases, there will be local appeals. The Utah case is special, though, signaling that the Supreme Court may be facing a much bigger issue on gay marriage than it faced in the historic last term. For a look at the Utah case, we turn to Suzanne Goldberg, professor at Columbia Law School, where she's also director of the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law. Professor, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Is the Supreme Court trying to avoid a full decision on whether regulation of same-sex marriage constitutes an unconstitutional infringement of people's rights under, say, the 14th Amendment?
Of course, it's hard to know exactly what the Supreme Court is trying to do or avoid. But what is clear is that the question is coming to the court whether states have to, consistent with the U.S. Constitution's promise of equality, offer marriage to same and different sex couples on the same basis.
What's going on in Utah is the district court basically affirmed a local court, and the Supreme Court has basically thrown a monkey wrench into what would have normally been a state regulatory litigation process, right?
That's pretty much it. The United States District Court judge declared that it was unconstitutional for Utah to exclude same-sex couples from marriage. The state then went and asked that judge to stay his decision, meaning to put it on hold, and he said no. They went up to the Federal Court of Appeals for that region, and that court, too, said, no, we're not going to put the lower court decision on hold because we don't think – well, they didn't actually give a reason, but usually the reason for not putting a decision on hold – is that we want to let the process go through. The decision below, we'll let it stand and we'll hear the appeal in the normal course of things. Utah then asked the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court put the decision on pause. This doesn't mean that marriages for same-sex couples will never resume in Utah. all this means is that we'll be waiting for the 10th Circuit to reach its decision in the case.
Now, this has nothing to do with the Defense of Marriage Act case that happened last year, but I'm wondering if there is some of the logic in the California case that went along with DOMA last term, where the Supreme Court appeared to resist intervening in what they felt was a state process in California. They're doing the same thing here in Utah, but the outcome is very different.
Well, the cases are all somewhat related to each other in the sense that they all ask a fundamental question: can the government have different rules for same-sex couples than it has for different-sex couples? You're right, though, that the California case from the Supreme Court's last term and this case both present the question about what can a state do? Can a state discriminate against gay couples in marriage? Last term, the Supreme Court avoided the question, but here, because the state of Utah is actually asking the higher courts to review the question about its marriage laws, there's more of a chance that the Supreme Court will ultimately have to confront the issue.
Finally, I see a process here whereby social mores change and all of a sudden something that was acceptable as social local standards becomes a 14th Amendment violation of due process and federal sort of principles. Is that what's going on here? And does this have implications way beyond same-sex marriage?
Well, I think what's going on here is that the country is moving toward recognizing that it is fundamentally unfair and unequal to have different marriage rules for same and different sex couples. It's part of the nature of our country. I mean, we have moved from a country that embraced slavery as consistent with promises, basic promises of the Constitution, to a country that not only rejected slavery, but has rejected sex discrimination, has moving toward now rejecting discrimination against lesbians and gay men, and in particular, same-sex couples.
The narrative
continues. So it's part
of
the arc of the country moving toward equality.
Suzanne Goldberg, professor at Columbia Law School, where she's also the director of the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We want to rummage now through your junk memory and possibly give you a flashback of an experience I suspect you may have had once or twice. You're at some event, some social business, whatever, and you get seated next to a perfect stranger, someone you would never encounter in your daily routine, not exactly a celebrity.
Herbert Hoover was known as the engineer president.
Oh, my goodness. Hoover and...
And the Hoover Dam was named after him.
Yeah? Oh. Mark Sheehan is an engineer, and he works on nuts and bolts and boilers and gaskets. He helps come up with the standards for them. He can tell the difference between a boiler and a potential bomb, he says.
So when you see that H stamp on that boiler, it's the manufacturer certifying that he has an ASME-accredited quality system and that boiler was inspected.
As Inspector Sheehan talks, I start to nod off, but then he starts to work his cheerful, I don't know, engineering magic, and I realize that he's the guy who's keeping the bridge I drive over from falling down. And you know, he might just be the most important person at this party.
There are a lot of people, thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of people around the world who dedicate themselves to standardization.
All this week, we are going to seat you next to people who don't speak in sound bites, but who in their own way quietly perform jobs as engineers that we all depend on. From setting the standards for nuts and bolts to designing usable technology for the developing world. Setting the standards all this week and later this hour, coming up on The Takeaway. You know, we learned on the program yesterday that the century-old 8-hour workday, as much as it has become a yardstick for measuring whether we worked hard today or kind of slacked off, basically, we learned it's something of a relic in a lot of professions.
My name is Leah. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio. I work more than 40 hours a week. I track billable hours for each client, and I am urged to meet my billable hours required and not go over that number. I do not get paid overtime, nor do I get a boost in my vacation bank. I'm told to work because I like to, but that gets hard when you hit over 80 hours a week.
So the number 40 is meaningful to Leah there, but it has nothing to do with how much she actually works. We wanted to have a little bit of a round table here with some folks for whom this is relevant, explore a little bit where the old 8-hour day fits today. Jason Fried is the co-founder and president of 37 Signals, a software company based in Chicago. Jason, welcome.
Hello.
Also with us is Sabina Gault, CEO of Connect PR, a public relations firm based in Los Angeles. Sabina, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on the show.
Now, we want to alert our listeners that your experiences are not meant to correspond to people who may be working at Foxconn right now, you know, assembling iPads or on the line at Burger King, but in general for professional, you know, white collar service oriented professions. Where does the 40-hour work week, 8-hour day fit in your world, Jason?
Well, we expect people to work about 40 hours, but no more than that. I mean, there's some times where people put in a few extra hours here and there, but I think if you want to build a long-term company, which is what we're about, you can't burn people out. So if you can get 60 or 70 hours from someone for a while, maybe you can do that, but in 2 years, 3 years, they're going to be exhausted, and I don't want that to happen.
But Henry Ford came up with this 40 hours thing arbitrarily. I guess I'm wondering what the magic is. Sabina, do you feel as though after 3 hours you got to take a break? After 8 hours, you're burnt out? Can you work 12 without a problem?
Well, we work in PR, so for us, it's a little bit different. I think in a typical profession, you kind of expect people to come in, do their job, take a break, get lunch, and then go home. And their job sort of ends once they reach that car or train or however they get home. In PR, your phone is on all the time. So it doesn't really matter that you're not at work. Many times you're still working because you have a client crisis, somebody's gone MIA, something is going wrong. So you constantly have to be checking your phone and email and make sure that, you know, you're not missing out on anything. So it's a little bit different for us from that perspective.
Well, and in that sense, PR resembles this profession in healthcare. Listen.
My name is Sandra Gents. I'm calling from Salt Lake City, Utah, and I'm a nurse practitioner in the field of palliative care. I work 9 to 5 regular hours, but we are a 24/7 service, and there's always one of us on call. This is not extra reimbursed time. It's just something that we do so that we always have someone available for this very important work.
Jason Fried, how do you compensate people or even measure their availability, their sort of on-duty, on-call status?
Well, okay, so medical work different, of course. Emergency work different. But I think most jobs are 8-hour-a-day jobs. And I think it's easy to find an excuse that says people have to be available more often than 8 hours because there's all sorts of other things going on. But the truth is most things can wait till tomorrow. There are very, very few true emergencies in business.
So we're 2 days to shipping date. I'd even call it shipping date on a software project anymore?
Sure. Yeah, yeah. And look, in those situations which come up a couple times a year, maybe someone has to put in a few extra hours, or maybe someone has to work a weekend. But those are rare exceptions, and I'd like to keep it that way.
Are those people compensated for overtime at time and a half, or is everybody on a sort of salary contract basis?
Everybody's on a salary, and so it's up to us to be fair to them and up to them to trust us that we're not going to push them beyond their normal hours that often.
As reasonable as you sound, Jason, the 8-hour workday, though, is something of a symbol. It's not an actual metric. It's a sort of a vague idea of what constitutes a workday, but you violate it as much as you honor it.
I don't think that's true. But what we don't do is track hours. So I trust people to work, to get the work done. All that matters to us is if the work is done or not. And if it's not done in a normal workday, then they finish it tomorrow rather than staying up too late. We're all human beings here. We're not superheroes. And if you work too much, you're going to leave the job. And I don't want people leaving. I want people to be happy here.
What's the burnout point for your folks, Sabina?
Well, we, you know, unlike Jason, we do track hours. And because we're in PR, so we have to make sure that clients know how much we're working on a certain account. And we do pay overtime. So if our employees that are non-exam pay work more than, you know, 40 hours a week or work weekends or work late nights, they do get compensated for that. And, you know, they submit a query and we approve it.
There's one exception for that, though, isn't there in your company, Sabina?
Yeah, like managers.
Like you.
And myself, yes, I'm an exception. But, you know, I think in PR in general, if this is the job that you love, is this is what you want to do. I've known people who have done PR their entire lives. And you learn how to take breaks. You learn how to make the job fun. So, yes, you're going on a client trip and you have 5 days of work. But at night, you're going out to nice dinners and you're enjoying friends and you're kind of spending your own time the way you want to. And if the client event doesn't start until 11 and you don't have to be there until 11, you sleep in until 9:30.
All right, Jason and Sabina, before we go, just assess your quality of life. You've given us a sense of your work responsibilities and how you orient your work time versus your non-work time. What's your quality of life on a scale from 1 to 10, Jason?
I think I'm pretty close to a 10. I've built a business that I like. I've hired people who like the work. We treat people fairly. I have extra time on the weekends. I have free time at night. I don't feel locked down by my job. And I think that's what it's all about.
Sabina, can you beat a 10?
I mean, personally, I think I have a 10. I think our team has probably somewhere between 7 and a 10. And that's just because a lot of the team members are newer and, you know, they're not yet used to, okay, how do I really strategize my time today? But just like Jason, you know, our benefits are ridiculous. We're by far one of the top firms that provides anything from full healthcare to extra perks to bonuses to summer Fridays. So I think that, you know, kind of adds on a little bit to the quality of life, kind of making work a little more fun.
Well, I suspect that some of our listeners may be contacting you today, Jason and Sabina. Thanks for being with us.
You bet. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Jason Fried is co-founder and president of 37 Signals, a software company in Chicago. Sabina Gault, CEO of Connect PR in Los Angeles, California. This is The Takeaway, and you know, here's another way work hours can get distorted and bloated. Karen from Olympia, Washington writes this: the place where I just left went from employing about 120 in 2008 to less than 80 today. How did they cover the labor loss? They expected everyone to absorb the workload of the others. My guess is that there are many others in the same situation, more responsibility without the pay. We'd love to know what you think about the 8-hour workday, 8778-MY-TAKE. Follow us on Twitter, at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway. But many of you prefer to talk about how the polar vortex this week is giving you a couple days off. From Kirkwood, Missouri, my husband and I are both educational sign language interpreters and are finishing up our holiday break. We now have 2 extra days off, which is great, but we don't get paid for them. It will really impact us financially.
Evan from Rockford, Illinois. My girlfriend and I were both called off work today, and we were sitting inside the house cleaning up after the holidays and enjoying a second day off together after not getting a day off together often.
Jim Run from Columbia, South Carolina. During these historic cold temperatures, I am staying inside and reading about global warming.
From Brooklyn, New York, one of you wishes they could do that. You need an engineer or a plumber. The back of our house in Brooklyn is partially open due to construction, leaving our pipes semi-exposed. So it's been a crazy time trying to keep them from freezing.
Marilyn Lowe, I'm calling from Eugene, Oregon. And it's freezing here, but it's a lot warmer than our low of minus 10 in December. We also have an air inversion, so our air quality is poor because of trapped wood smoke and car exhaust. But other than that, we're doing great.
A lot of wood stoves there in Western Oregon. Not so many in Pulaski, Tennessee, though. We used to heat with propane, but you can't trust that it will be delivered in bad weather, so we installed a cast iron wood stove this year. Toasty.
My name is Mike, calling from Woodland Park, New Jersey. We're dealing with the cold by not going outside as much for dog walks. While he doesn't like it, it's, you know, quite unfortunate that that's the case. We are just hanging out inside and keeping warm. I say bring it on.
Hanging out with the dogs. Boston, Massachusetts. Breathing is more difficult the colder it is and prevents us from going out for doctor's appointments when you have to use public transportation. Milford, New Hampshire. Car won't start reliably. A lot of that. Stranded for 2 days away from home, probably having to invest in a different car for reliable transportation to work.
Christine in Queens, this extreme weather is making me really nervous, especially about driving on icy roads. And then I'm not sure or confident that my old car will work if these temperatures plunge below zero. And then again, I'm thinking about the pipes and the utility wires in and around my home, and that makes me a little anxious. guess I'll just have to do the best that I can. I hope everyone stays safe.
Any help for Christine out there? Not much from Seattle, Washington. I'm in Seattle, so it's been mellow due to the jet stream shoving the cold air east. I dealt with sustained sub-zero temps on a regular basis growing up in eastern Washington, down to 60 below with wind chill. People need to stop being whiny. Well, here's an East Coast whine.
Alan Fence in Brooklyn, New York. It seems none of the weather people are discussing the connection between this extreme cold phenomenon and global warming. When warm ocean waters cause historic glaciers to melt in large quantities, at the moment they're melting, they're absorbing vast quantities of heat from the water in the air, causing a temporary chill. And unless they understand that, people will make the wrong decisions.
A scientifically sophisticated whine about climate change. How do you feel about the Polar Express that may have hit your neighborhood? 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. A mystery solved, but a pattern of government abuse of power repeated. Our colleagues at Retro Report have broken a story with the help of journalist Betty Metzger about an unsolved burglary more than 40 years ago that broke a case of government surveillance wide open. Here's the voice of NBC News anchor John Chancellor.
Secret FBI memos made public today show that the late J. Edgar Hoover ordered a nationwide campaign to disrupt the activities of the new left without telling any of his superiors about it.
The documents were stolen from an FBI office outside Philadelphia, where the mystery has remained until this day. Bonnie Bertram, Retro Report producer, joins us now. Bonnie, welcome.
Hi, nice to be here.
So what were the circumstances of the FBI memos that were leaked out? Where did they come from? How much mystery surrounded their origin?
Well, Betty Metzger was a journalist at the Washington Post, and when the burglars went into the FBI field office and media, they found lots of documents. And sifting through them, they found what was an article that had a routing slip, and it had a word COINTELPRO, the new left. And no one really knew what that meant. And it took 2 years before Carl Stern at NBC, after he had filed some FOIA documents, to get to the bottom of what that exactly meant.
And what this showed was a portrait of the U.S. government doing what?
Systematically harassing, surveilling, trying to undermine the efforts of groups that Hoover and the FBI considered a threat to national security, and basically a whole lot of people he just didn't like.
And the burglars remained unknown.
The burglars are an incredible story. Here were these eight people. The FBI had no idea who they were, and it was one of the greatest manhunts in FBI history. They had nearly 200 investigators on the case and almost 5 years, and they still, of the final list of seven that they had winnowed it down to, only one of them was actually one of the burglars.
Hmm. So let's meet Bonnie Raines and John Raines. Tell me a little bit about how central they are to this story.
Well, they were one of the first people that the mastermind approached. I think he approached them in some reason because they might have been so atypical. John was a Methodist minister and a religion professor at Temple University, and Bonnie ran a daycare center and was a graduate student. And Bonnie told me that they had been radicalized by some really terrific nuns as part of the East Coast conspiracy to save lives. It was a group of Catholic activists who were trying to fight the Vietnam War.
And here's Bonnie Raines speaking to you here.
I was to call the office and make an appointment as a Swarthmore student doing research on opportunities for women in the FBI. So they gave me an appointment. I tried to disguise myself as best I could, and I went to say goodbye, and I acted confused about where the door was, and that gave me a chance then to check out both rooms and know where the file cabinets were.
So here this daycare center worker went undercover.
She certainly did. I mean, she had done some casing before of draft boards, but she was really instrumental. And they all used to meet at their house, and Bonnie used to make a spaghetti dinner for all of the burglars. And she said, you know, I was tired of cooking dinner, and I really wanted to take on a big job.
Here's a sense from John Raines, who's married to Bonnie, is that right?
Right.
Who was completely outraged by the sense of government oppression of the time.
We knew the FBI was systematically trying to squash dissent, and dissent is the lifeblood of democracy.
Is this a Snowden story from a previous generation, do you think?
I think it is. I think it's, you know, a reaction when people rise up against what they see as government wrongdoing. But, John, what's so remarkable is that in the 70s, it was such a different climate where the FBI was really sort of squaring off mano a mano against these people who they considered enemies. Bonnie was followed when she was dropping her kids off at daycare. They were in the station wagon, and they'd wave to the FBI guy who was their tail. And I think that for a lot of protesters in the spring of 1970, when Nixon announced the invasion of Cambodia and when Kent State happened, they sort of threw down their peace signs and said, that's it. We've got to take up arms here and do something more radical. It's not, the work that we're doing is not changing things.
Criminals, heroes, how do they feel about themselves and their
behavior?
Well,
that's for you to judge, John. I think a lot of people consider them heroes, and I think a lot of people consider them criminals, not so different from Edward Snowden.
Retro Report bringing to light the mystery solved of a burglary in the 1970s that shows the U.S. government once again going after U.S. citizens in its surveillance of Americans critical of the government. Bonnie Bertram, Retro Report producer, thanks so much.
Sure, a pleasure.
The story of the mysterious burglary is reported in depth in a new book by former Washington Post journalist Betty Metzger, The Burglary, Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI. Come right this way now. Let's seat you next to engineer Mark Sheehan, who we met earlier this hour, and begin a series of unusual conversations. This week, we want to get to know the team of people whose profession it is to create and monitor standards for safety and compatibility so we can rely on the tools that we have come to rely on as necessities in a world continually transformed by technology. Meeting the standard is one part public service, one part democracy, and two parts hard science and engineering. For more than a century, the American Society of Mechanical Engineers, the ASME, has voluntarily formulated standards for all sorts of industrial materials, from simple nuts and bolts to complicated machines. Standards adopted worldwide. We think of the United Nations as an example of international cooperation, but without the ASME and its sister organizations around the world, virtually nothing in the global economy would be workable. Later in the week, we'll be talking about standards for everything from nuclear power plants to standards for the workout devices and medical tools keeping you on top of your New Year's resolutions. But first, Mark Sheehan, Managing Director for Development Standards and Certification at the ASME. Engineers like Mark may be working on the cusp of new technologies, but that doesn't mean he can play Captain Kirk or Indiana Jones around the dinner table.
The message I usually tell people when they ask me, you know, what it is you do, and I tell them standards and say, you know, what's that about that? And it's a simple fact that you can't touch anything that there isn't a standard associated with. It's a part of everyday life. You know, some are sexier than others, but there it is.
That makes me think that when you walk around the world, you go, uh-uh, that's not quite right.
Yeah. Engineers have a habit of doing things like that. You know, they're the ones who straighten the pictures in the room, that sort of thing.
Right, exactly. And for how long have engineers been really doing this huge straightening the pictures in the room sort of safety standards development thing in an organized way?
For ASME, it goes back to 1884.
Wow.
We were originally formed in 1880, and one of the first things that they determined was the need for standards for boiler efficiencies, screw threads, so the nuts fit the bolts and things like that.
And so the call goes out. Boilers are blowing up. We need somebody to figure out what is an acceptable boiler and what is not, and the engineers get to work.
Right. And actually, if your home is heated by hot water or steam, okay, the boiler in the basement is going to have an ASME certification mark on it. It's a clover leaf with an H inside of it for heating boilers. And this goes back to that 1914, when the first boiler code was issued by ASME. They had the rules for construction, but they needed some way to assess conformity with that. And so the ASME developed a program by which state inspectors and insurance inspectors would go to a manufacturer and determine whether or not they were able to meet the requirements of the boiler code.
All right, so boilers blow up. We definitely want standards there. How do you come up with something like that with a screw or a nut or a nail? Well,
that's more interchangeability of parts. You need to know, for instance, plumbing fixtures.
Right.
You need to know that when you go down to Home Depot and you pick out your new bathroom set, that when you bring it back to your house, it's going to fit into the mountings on the floor. It's going to fit into the fixtures on the wall.
I've always wondered, how it all does fit.
Yeah.
Because
those are ASME standards.
Really?
Yeah.
You guys did that.
Our A112 series of standards.
So beyond plumbing fixtures, boilers, consumer items, what about really high stress, high risk items?
Those are the areas that ASME is most famous for, and that's highly engineered equipment used in the petrochemical industry, in the power generation industry, and also nuclear power generation.
Describe to me the ethos that exists in that sophisticated stuff and in the lowly screw at the same time.
Well, that's a part of the blessing and the curse of ASME is that we run the gamut of equipment. You know, something as simple as a screw thread all the way up to a nuclear containment vessel. The way to get your hands around it is to just look at what the scope of the standard is supposed to be for a bolt or a screw thread. And that's basically dimensional. A screw thread is much more engineered, and a gear is even more so. The teeth of a gear are very highly engineered because they have to take the stresses from multiple angles as the gear goes through its engagement. And the other thing is that you can get the dimensions for a nut and a bolt, but picking the right material for the strength of that bolted connection is another decision entirely. The elevator you came up here in, ASME standards. The boiler that heats this building, ASME standards. The toilet in the bathroom, ASME standards.
You ever said that at a party?
Yeah.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
Right.
But they were very close friends.
I see. Very close. That's really good. How much of this is an American thing, that American industry developed this ethos of standards that's now global?
No, it's evolved in every country that's made its way through or is making its way through their industrial evolution. So while the United States was in the 1800s and early 1900s developing its own industry and its own set of standards, same thing was happening in Germany, UK, France, Italy. When all of a sudden the manufacturing capacity of a nation exceeds the demand in that nation, what do they look for? They look for exports. So if a U.S. company wants to export to France,
it's got to meet the standards.
They got to meet the French standards.
So for people who are considering becoming engineers, I mean, there's all this talk about STEM education and there is a need for scientifically trained people. Pitch your profession to young people who might be listening.
Well, there's no question in my mind that solutions to the problems that face us is going to come through engineering and science. If we're going to be able to find a way to power our economy and our lifestyle into the future – and do so in a manner that does not further damage the planet, at least, and reduce the damage that's been done at best, those answers are going to have to come from engineers and scientists.
And are all the standards going to be made in China in 20 years?
Actually, we have an office in China. And that's exactly that's one of the things that we're working on. And as China develops their standards capacity, they draw on ASME standards as much as possible and at the very least develop standards that are compatible with U.S. standards so that there's a level playing field for trade between the two countries. I've been at it for over 35 years, but it's kept me going, especially on the international scene. The international aspect of standards is very dynamic and interesting in it may sound like a boring subject, but there are a lot of people, thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of people around the world who dedicate themselves to standardization.
In the Hollywood movie about the guy who does the engineering standards, who would play you?
Bruce Willis, because every time I go to Asia, they tell me I look like Bruce Willis.
Mark Sheehan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Mark Sheehan is Managing Director for Development Standards and Certification at the American Society of Mechanical Engineers. Part two of our Meeting the Standard series continues tomorrow. In the annals of awkward moments, here's one.
Philomena, how are you?
I had a hip replacement last year, Martin. Titanium, so it won't rust.
Otherwise, I'd have to oil you like the Tin Man.
Is that right?
Oh, no.
He's just joking, Mum.
Oh. It's from the latest film by brilliant British director Stephen Frears, Philomena, starring Judi Dench. It's the story of BBC reporter Martin Sixsmith on the trail of a woman's lost child put up for adoption under questionable circumstances. A different kind of story than this wonky journalist, played by Steve Coogan, typically tells.
You're talking about a human interest story, and that's... I don't do those.
Why not?
You think I should do a human interest story?
In Philomena, Frears makes an unlikely on-screen collaboration work magic, as he did in the Oscar-winning The Queen, and such films as The Grifters, My Beautiful Laundrette, Dangerous Liaisons, and High Fidelity. People with powerful emotions colliding with terrified souls afraid of commitment, love, and passion. Frears prefers to find stories that get to the heart of the matter, whatever the subject, and then describes his work as a kind of winding it all up and stepping back. Stephen Frears says any genius in directing is about getting out of the way.
The imaginative work was really done by Steve Coogan, who created the relationship between Martin Sixsmith, the journalist, and Philomena, which just, I don't think, really existed. And he invented all of that, or he and his co-writer Jeff Pope invented all of that. So when I read it, I gave them a copy of It Happened One Night, because that was a film about an incongruous relationship.
Were you terrified of this working together, or did it seem like an absolute natural?
No, I thought they'd be good chemistry. You know, people come up to you with sort of raised, ooh, you want to watch out. But it always seemed to me they'd be very, very good, and that it was the contrast, it was the oppositionism that was made it so interesting. Judy adored Steve. He just used to make her laugh and laugh.
Which is always useful,
yes,
on a set.
No. Yeah. I mean, it was what you dream about, good chemistry. But she would laugh a lot, and then they'd go into a scene, so the warmth would sort of hang over, or the intimacy.
What do you think happens to her during the course of this movie, whether it was true or not in the book?
Well, she's forced to confront things about her son, and then she's forced to accept this dreadful chap who's taking her around, so she learns a lot in her way. But, of course, she starts being wiser than he is, or it turns out that she's wiser than he is.
It's a kind of the tortoise and the hare, both reluctant learners, but you start Judi Dench ahead of Coogan, and
yes,
she wins the race.
Well, she is ostensibly she's uneducated, she's simpler, she has faith. I mean, she doesn't have the things that modern people are supposed to have.
The things that ruin people, like being a journalist.
Absolutely. Yes. She's very, very lucky. It's terrible. To make a film in which a journalist is a hero, it's really a betrayal.
Yeah, after you did The Queen,
yes.
Where the journalists aren't the heroes there
absolutely.
Either.
Absolutely, absolutely.
That's for sure. You know, I also look at your career and just see the amazing actors that you've worked with and how you're so lucky to get them early. Daniel Day-Lewis. Albert Finney, you didn't get early, but you certainly got him
It's called
Gumshoe.
Poverty. It's called not having the money to afford more famous people. So you have to use the people who are around you, who are, by the grace of God, still cheap. So Dan was, as it were, Dan wasn't remotely famous. Always very, very good.
Do they retain a sense of chemistry with you? Even though you know them when?
I stay friends with them, but...
Yeah.
But
well, you brought out of them so much as a director, it seems to me.
Yes,
you're not just a flick the camera on
the
director.
I don't quite understand that because, you know, all you do is really preside over the moment when they come to the surface. You know, it's not the Svengali act that you as a journalist would like it to be. But you're there when it happens.
Give me a break. All you do is preside over the moment when it comes.
Yes.
A director, that is beyond humility for a movie director.
It's not. It's actually the truth. What you learn as a director is how easy it is to make matters worse. I'm being absolutely serious. You can very, very easily make matters worse. And I've spent a lot of my life making matters worse and realizing that's what I was capable of doing. Dan, to talk about Dan, he was desperate for that part. He knew absolutely that if he could get that part, he could change his life and he could show people he wasn't, you know, the upper-class boy that he was always playing before that.
Daniel Day-Lewis in My Beautiful Laundrette.
Yes, that's right. So he went out of his way to get it. And, you know, I should be so lucky. So it's very, very hard. There are directors who are interested in actors' performances and how they get to their performance. That's not me. I just expect that one day one to be very, very good.
You also are a connoisseur of scripts. Hanif Qureshi wrote My Beautiful Laundrette, and I don't know how long that kicked around before you found it, or did you find it and go, this is absolutely
I don't think it's been around very long, but I read it and said, this is very, very good, we should do this now. Now, meaning now, rather than in a year's time.
Right.
We were lucky that everything fell into place, and we did do it then.
And you basically heralded a moment of British culture and world culture in the sense of understanding this mixing between the gay world, the straight world?
Yes, again, it's not quite as clear-eyed as you would like it to be. You know, I said this is very, very good. We should do it now. As the life of the film unfolded after we'd made it, you started to discover why it was so significant and why it was so substantial and what a great writer Hanif was and how it had captured a moment of time. I don't think, all I said was, this is very good, we should do it now. But if you'd said to me, well, why is it good? What's good about this? I couldn't have told you.
No, and that's what journalists ask. And you know.
So I better stick to being a film director.
Any attention. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'll trade any time, pal, okay? How about that? Give me 5 minutes.
But you understand the world, or you seek to understand, or you know everything. I always think journalists know everything. I'm not sure they make best use of their knowledge, but.
I do know everything.
I think so, yes.
Yeah, I did. But you're the only person that's actually told me that on the air. My wife tells me that, and it's usually an insult.
Yes, no, I understand.
Right. So
in a sense, I was brought up at the Royal Court Theatre in London, where they taught you to appreciate good writing. They taught you your place, that the writers were preeminent, that the writing was central. And they cast very, very well. So really, if you asked me, I would say I was blessed with good taste in material and good taste in actors, and I've kept my mouth shut.
What's next? Best director? Is that in the cards for you?
No. Oldest director. I'd win it, hands down.
Would you?
Who's at my age?
Let's see.
Scorsese's younger.
Right. Little boy.
So I'm going for the oldest director nomination.
Is Milos Forman still around?
Yes, but he hasn't made a film.
Right. Okay. So.
No, I'm not the oldest director in the world. Right. I'm just the oldest one who's
who could win an Oscar.
Who's got a film out at the moment.
The first.
Oldest director, that'd be a wonderful category. Oh, I'm happy to go into that one.
Thanks so much, Stephen Frears.
It's a pleasure.
Stephen Frears' new film playing now in theaters is Philomena, starring Judi Dench and Steve Coogan. And from that very warm conversation, we turn to your thoughts about the polar vortex that's all over America. Samantha writes, I'm a teacher in Connecticut, and my school has preemptively canceled for tomorrow. Sandy in Florida writes, though, one of the good things about living in Miami is the winter weather. We've gotten a ton of unseasonal rain, but our high tomorrow will be in the 50s. Chilly for Sandy, a dream for us in the Northeast. If we didn't know any better, Sandy, we'd say you were trying to rub things in our faces. Give us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a vortex of tweets at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.